KCSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to have on the show Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan, author of the book The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Hearsay Culture from time to time has had scholars on discussing the world of search, people like Professor James Grimmelman and Frank Pasquale and others. In The Googleization of Everything, Shiva takes a broader look at the world of search and really takes a closer look at what he calls Googleization as opposed to Google. So how we store and use information and how search engines really, but Google more specifically, have changed how we use and consume information. So we're going to focus today not as much on Google, but really on this broader idea of Googleization. Should we be concerned about Google as the repository of information is really a jumping off point for a broader discussion of what this idea means, what Googleization is. And of course, the title suggests that the impact of this way of organizing information, Googleization, goes well beyond the ideas of search. So in Shiva's book, we're going to be discussing a variety of areas where this comes up. And in his table of contents, he refers to the ideas of surveillance and the ideas of internationalization and books, as well as memory and information organization. So it's a very wide-ranging book. It's a book particularly timely and important, and I'm excited to have Shiva on today. By way of very brief background, Shiva is a professor of media studies and law at the University of Virginia, is the author of the previous book, Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity, and a book that I'm quite familiar with and enjoyed reading when it came out a few years ago, The Anarchist in a Library, How the Clash Between Freedom and Control is Hacking the Real World and Crashing the System. So I'm excited to have Shiva on today, who is joining us by Skype from his home in Charlottesville. This show is being recorded on the day that it will air, March 8th. So Shiva, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's good to be here.
Shiva, let's start off with a general question that I ask virtually all of my authors. Tell us a bit about the genesis of this project and why you wrote this book.
Yeah, well, back in 2004, late 2004, early 2005, I was struck by the audacity that Google had exhibited when it declared it was going to scan millions of books in from multiple university libraries around the world. I thought, unlike many of my colleagues, that Google was not necessarily the white knight coming to save the notion of the information ecosystem or expand into some grand digital universal library. Instead, I saw this as I said, an audacious move by a company that had as yet unrevealed interests in this project. Now, since that time, we've actually seen the extent to which their interests are revealed. The book search program, which now is called Google Books, has, of course, morphed into a bookstore. It no longer pretends to be a library. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but sometimes people still refer to it as some sort of library project. But beyond that, we know that Google's very interested in having a tremendous amount of text, a tremendous amount of syntax that it can use to mine and can use to help develop some fairly new and exciting methods of search. Now, again, that's a really bold and innovative move, and I applaud Google for its vision, right? But it's not about us; it's about Google. And so, building from that experience, where I sort of broke with many of my friends and peers about the what I saw was was actually a less than ideal move into the digitization of libraries. I wanted to look at this larger question. What exactly is our relationship with Google? How has Google managed in about a decade to infiltrate so many important parts of our life? And not just infiltrate. I mean, that sounds a little bit scary, but what Google's done is it's convinced us, gently convinced us, that we should trust it so implicitly that we almost never click past the top three results in a search list, right? So that's an amazing thing, that we just go with it, right? We just go with what Google presents us, and that means that Google has a tremendous amount of influence over what's important in the world. And so it really started from some heavy questions that I think the book program brought up, but then it quickly expanded into taking on this larger account. How is Google operating in terms of how it treats us? What is our relationship to Google? And how does that flow globally? I mean, I was really interested in Google's relationship with China, and Google's failure to break into the Russian market in any major way. Google's tremendous success in India and in Europe. In fact, greater success than Google's even had in the U.S. I mean, all of these questions are really fascinating to me, and I'm thrilled that Google's actually laid it all out for me. It was a crazy book to write, though, because of course every month Google does something new and bold that shifts the story a little bit. But I'm happy to say I was able to take a big picture view. At least I think I took a big enough picture view that the issues I bring out in the book are going to be relevant for a number of years, even if the details aren't quite so relevant.
You mentioned this long-term project, and I know that we've been chatting about you being on the show for a few years at least. And I guess I want to focus a bit on these events. What now brings the book to fruition, to the market? Have there been particular events over the last, as you decide, okay, we're going, that takes several months in and of itself. So what's new now that makes this book, or in your view as the author, makes this the right time to have the book out there?
Oh, well, I think the right time was probably 24 months ago, but this is a good time.
Why 24 months ago?
So right now what we have is this really interesting set of pressures on Google that actually didn't exist 24 months ago so clearly. And that is that Google is facing two pressures, long-term pressures to its potential for garnering revenue. The first is Facebook, and the second is Apple, and that's largely because we're shifting more and more of our attention time to these mobile devices. As Jonathan Zittrain explains in his book, as we shift to these fairly locked down mobile devices with high levels of control built into them, we're doing something very different. We're giving a different set of market signals. We are essentially opting for the tightly controlled over the radically open, and that has both costs and benefits. One of the big costs to Google is every minute you spend on an iPhone app is a minute not spent on the web, and a minute not spent on the web is a minute that Google can't harvest to make its search engine better, and most importantly for Google, can't target ads for, right? So Google saw, and I think appropriately, that that this tremendous boom in smartphone usage in the United States and Europe anyway meant that Google couldn't be complacent about that area. So it went boldly into the mobile space and hasn't been as idealistic as it had pretended to be at the beginning, of course. The second thing is Facebook, which, over the past 4 years has of course consumed a tremendous amount of our time and attention to the point where, who knows, maybe the recession it's all about that. But you know, the thing about Facebook is it's a direct competitor for advertising dollars in a way that no other firm or institution really is for Google. And I think that explains some of the major changes in Google in recent years, in recent months, in fact. You know, Google is consistently emphasizing the recent over the older search results. And that's a fairly new move. I mean, in the sense that it's, you know, the timestamp is a much more important part of how Google places its search results, and you know, trying to be more current, and that's in some way a reaction to Twitter, but much more a reaction to Facebook. And the second thing is, Google's trying to emphasize the relevance of search ads to a particular person, meaning that these search ads are generated not just, I mean, these search results, sorry, these search results are generated not just because of the overall score of a particular page in terms of the web at large, but really customized and localized to not only what you and I tell Google, but what people like us tell Google and what people around us tell Google is important. And so these changes have really been current and are, you know, in play right now. And I think that one of the stories I'm trying to tell in the book, one of the arguments I'm trying to make in the book, is that Google is increasingly becoming better for shopping, and that necessarily means it's becoming worse for learning. And we've had a good decade, a good 12 years of dealing with a service that managed to do both reasonably well in a fast changing and challenging environment where neither of those things were a given, nor particularly easy. Somehow Google's managed to make money for itself and for many others, and managed to show us our world in about the most reasonable way most people could imagine. That's not to say that there haven't been glitches along the way and abnormalities, but overall, you know, it's been a pretty good ride. I'm not sure that ride's going to continue. I think that as Google's under more pressure to keep the web relevant in our lives and keep itself in front of our eyes, it's going to do what it has to remain important and generate this level of revenue. And that means that it's probably going to shift more toward shopping and away from learning.
We're chatting with Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan, author of the book, The Googleization of Everything, on Hearsay Culture and KZSU Stanford. Shiva, you know, I want to come back to a little later the announcements over the past week that Google was revamping its algorithm, which, of course, is a secret, so it's hard to know what they're doing. But before we get there, let's define, I attempted to do in my introduction, but let's define this term Googleization. So what are you, you're focusing not particularly on Google as an entity, although that's a big part of the story, but on a broader idea of Googleization. So what is that, and how does the structure of the book fit into it?
Yeah, so Googleization is the process of being rendered by Google, of having some important thing run through the Google system and subjected to the ideologies and decisions and algorithms of the company. And that means that it's you know, by focusing on the Googleization of information, right? The notion that information and the relative value of information is not presented in an ideal or neutral form, but instead is presented in a form that reflects the decisions baked into the algorithm. I think that's a really important insight, especially as we use Google. We should constantly be aware of the fact that, you know, Google is making decisions, value-based decisions, in everything it does. You know, I also pay a lot of attention to the Googleization of us, our identities, our preferences, our predilections and prejudices, and the ways that we, you know, we feed Google that kind of information, thus making Google smarter constantly. And the Googleization of communication, the extent to which Google is increasingly important in the very act of connecting one person to another. Certainly, Google has nowhere near a monopoly on any form of communication, but it is setting the standards in email. It is It is currently the best-selling mobile phone platform. It's shaking up the mobile world around the world. And of course, it's experimenting with all sorts of other ways to connect us through voice and through video, et cetera. So these are the three major areas that I paid attention to. The term Googleization is a bit older than my project. A number of people sort of invoked it. But I really felt like it matched the story I was trying to tell. I was not trying to tell the story of the company. I was not trying to write a biography or a hagiography of the company. I was not trying to write a tirade against the company. I really want us as Google users and as citizens to ask hard and cynical questions about how we use it and what it does for us and with us. Incidentally, the choice of the word Googleization and the choice not to include Google in the title of the book was an explicit choice not to bow to our search engine masters. And what I mean by that is, like, if you go to Amazon right now and you search Google in the book section, you will not find my book on the first page, or I think on the first three pages, which is unfortunate and perhaps unwise on my part. if you go to Google and you search Google under books, you won't find it either. You actually have to search for Googleization or somehow figure out how to spell my name. And so I may have lost a good number of sales.
You need a search engine game.
Titles are increasingly optimized for search engines. Titles of books. Just as much as anything.
Yeah, I was going to say you need a search engine optimizer to help you take care of that.
Well, you know, I kind of went against it. I went to a search engine minimizer in my own mind. And, I haven't really had this conversation with my publisher yet about the fact that, you know, I did dodge the potential of actually being snared by search engines in a better way. And by the way, one of the things that you learn when you pay a lot of attention to search engines is just how bad Amazon's search service is. It is truly abysmal. It is entirely based on the words contained in the title, and the closer to the front of the title the search term appears, the higher the rank will be. And there doesn't seem to be much more added to it, much more in terms of a sophisticated search service. And that's actually kind of comical. So I love showing my students the differences between how Amazon judges relevance and how Google judges relevance. And I think one of the basic reasons is Amazon could have done a much better job on search if it needed to, right? It really won't enhance its value as an online service. But secondly, if it had really stuck to books and not branched out into every possible product.
Mm-hmm. Well, that it's interesting you mentioned that, because that's a good segue into a jumping off point on some of your critique, which gets to this idea of market failure, and it's something, you know, it's something that we know and that you talk about in the book. In the absence of a usable way to find information on the internet, Google steps into the breach and improves upon, it seems, previous iterations of search engines that came from other companies. And they have filled a void that existed in having this search engine, which, as you acknowledge, is pretty good at what it does. So if Google is correcting or addressing a market failure, to use the subtitle of your book, why should we worry?
Well, Google's actually filling in Google's actually filling in many ways public failures, the failures of state institutions to really fulfill their obligation. And mostly by this I mean the process of building a global digital library, which we actually have in our vision and we have the technology to do, but we don't have the political will to do at this point. And it actually would not cost that much money when it came to amortizing it over time and spreading the cost over a variety of state institutions. But, you know, we've just not had the ability to have that conversation or to forge an agenda until now, actually. It's just starting to happen here in 2011. The Berkman Center at Harvard and Harvard Libraries are starting a really rich conversation about creating a digital public library of America, inspired by Robert Darnton's work. And there are a number of other projects going on around the world in Europe and so forth that are trying to set up a public alternative to the services that Google has put forth. Now, what's really interesting about that is that we seem timid and incapable of that full on vision when it came to the public sector leaders in the field of librarianship. People saw the opportunity to digitize everything and create a tremendous amount of access, but nobody wanted to act on it. Nobody really wanted to even list the problems that would get in our way. And so one of the things I wanted to do here was explain that Google, like a lot of companies, takes advantage of its sterling reputation to try to make a point that it can do things better than the public sector, or at least faster and cheaper, if not better. And I wanted to sort of explode that idea a little bit. I worry a lot that this notion of public failure undermines a lot of important state functions. I mean, I think about the fact that we have, sort of in the United States, we've systematically dismantled the ability of the public sector to react in an effective way to things like natural disasters or, the needs to educate the vast majority of students adequately. Instead we've used these designed failures to justify even less public investment in public goods. And so I see Google as part of that problem. It's certainly not the biggest element of that problem. But I wanted to get us to start thinking about the extent to which we rely on companies that plead benevolence and claim to be socially responsible to solve our problems purely on the basis of consumerism.
So let's talk a bit about what you perceive as a myth in the history of Google and the perception of Google as something other than another profit-making entity. As you talk about, and as you say in the book, you don't view Google as evil, but they are not morally good either. So first let me ask you about that myth. And, you mentioned having broken with friends, and I, at least spent a couple of years in Silicon Valley, and seeing that culture firsthand. I definitely see that there was this, this view of Google as almost altruistic, and while that is no longer the case in that extreme form, I tend to agree with you that we still have this largely benevolent view of Google. So, where do you think that myth or that idea came from? Was it marketing by Google or something more than that?
I think it was us and not Google. Google's internal motto, "Don't be evil," has never been part of its public face. The story got out pretty early that engineers at Google were deeply concerned that in the early days, as Google started hiring regular business folks to do the regular business parts, that that the swashbuckling spirit of the early years of the company wouldn't last very long. So the story that "Don't Be Evil" has been an important part of the conversations within Google certainly got out into media accounts, into the press fairly early, and that's been a profound influence on Google's reputation. But I don't think Google did it quite in terms of a campaign. My sense is that we wanted so desperately for a big, rich, successful company run by decent people who had a decent view of the world to succeed, and not only succeed, but succeed in the terms that reflected the prevailing ideology of the web. So, the web, those of us who celebrate the web as the web, have always wanted to point out that companies should probably recognize that it is better to institute light or no control than heavy control, right? And that companies that work on the web should do as little censorship as possible, should stand up for openness and use open code whenever possible. Should be happy with letting people use their APIs and build amazing things, as Google has done with Google Maps and so forth. And so at every step, Google has reflected the desires and expectations of the web elite, right? People who actually make web pages or who study them or use them voraciously. And by doing that and by satisfying the elites, Google's managed to spread a tremendous amount of goodwill. At the same time, Google managed to leverage its cash and its position to make a service that harvests more information than any other search engine and uses it to present search results in a remarkably almost magic way, really fast. So, but Google's image of benevolence, which the major people at the company do talk about, they just don't use the phrase "don't be evil." Eric Schmidt has a number of times in the past couple of years explained away challenges to Google's power in the market by saying, "Well, you really have nothing to worry about because this company is built upon certain principles, and we're not going to violate our principles," which to me is no kind of guarantee at all. But we're just so happy that some companies seem to be espousing principles. Remember, Google's rise came in the wake of what we thought was a permanent and debilitating domination by Microsoft, which takes very few opportunities to talk about corporate social responsibility. It's even though actually Microsoft does practice it in many ways, it's just not a part of Microsoft's public face and never has been. Microsoft was founded against hackers, against free software, against the Homebrew Computer Club. And so it's always been, the villain of the more open and anarchistic culture of code making, and Google was the sort of place that said, "Look, you know, if you believe in the power of an open web and open code, come on, work for us, and we'll have a lot of fun." And that's worked out for a lot of people. A lot of people work at Google when they could make more money at other companies, so that's been. That's been a good ride for Google, and so within Silicon Valley, it's real easy to see how that reputation spread and why it mattered. It helps, I think, first and foremost in recruiting talent, and people who actually want to make a difference with the work that they do, and I think they're sincere about that. But what really fascinates me is the extent to which that reputation has spread into the larger public. And I think affected a lot of people's vision of the company and suspended our willingness to ask hard questions, I think, at important times. And as you said, that's really starting to change. Google has grown big enough and gone into enough areas of commerce and life that it's starting to create some real friction. And as it creates real friction, we start to see the hypocrisies and the contradictions at root in how the company operates.
We're chatting with Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the book "The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry." We're going to pick up on some of those tensions after the break here, Shiva. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM Stanford, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, it's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you could go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, we do hope that you continue to listen to the station. So let's talk about areas that you have identified, Shiva, as having been Googleized, if I could now use the word slightly differently. One of the areas that you focus on, and I think it sets the stage for that discussion, is this story involving a United Airlines bankruptcy story that had particular impact on the value of United Airlines stock. And this was a direct result of search. So perhaps you could tell us that story and how it connects to the concerns that you have.
Well, so this is a story about metadata,
right.
Which, you know, Everyone's thrilled by stories about metadata.
Can you define it for listeners that aren't familiar?
Yeah. So metadata, of course, is the data that sits around a document that helps describe its purpose, its date. You know, you can think of the information on a library catalog page being the metadata to a book. So what you have is you have a small Florida newspaper that opens up its archive to Google's spiders to search, and at some point, probably in the newspaper itself, the date was stripped from a particular story about United Airlines filing for bankruptcy protection, which had happened a number of years earlier. But of course, Google's algorithms don't sense this and send it out into the world. Somebody at one of the Bloomberg financial systems came across it on Google News, panicked and thought that here was United Airlines freshly emerged from reorganization. Once again, teetering and having big problems. So he or she sent that out as an alert, which caused a major sell-off of United Airlines stock during the course of a day. And because so many automatic trading systems are sort of sector-based, a lot of other airlines suffered losses that day as well because of this massive sell-off. Of United Airlines stock. By the end of the day, once Bloomberg had issued a correction, by the end of the day, United Airlines and many of the other airlines had recovered a significant portion of the day's slide, but they all lost some money, which is just a stunning thought. That a piece of information badly labeled would whip around the universe so quickly without anyone asking questions about its veracity is and thus causing an actual effect in the world. That's a pretty amazing process, and it struck me as the kind of story that really explains what we're up against with Googleization. And let me be clear, I don't think this was Google's fault. I don't think you can actually design a search system that ensures that the metadata of every source presented by some other server is accurate and appropriate. But we do know that we reward Google for throwing information at us incredibly quickly. And so we, as users, and by we I include the person at Bloomberg who sent this around, who I think is truly at fault, we just trust it. And that, to me, is the big problem. We don't say, hey, maybe this story that Google just pulled up for me sounds a little bit off, and let me double check on the date. Let me do a few other searches in other areas. Let me do a LexisNexis search to see if this story is new or old. Those sorts of steps, which, any librarian would do almost instantly, is something that we're not quite attuned to do. And I think we risk a lot of similar mistakes in the future if we don't understand that, Google's algorithms are not perfect, are not always trustworthy, and they're merely a place to start, and these days to get stuff fast, but not necessarily best.
And you know, and I think that gets us to an interesting categorization that you discuss in the book, where you have these categories, as you call them, of responsibility. And there are three that you identify: scan and link, the second being host and serve, and the last being scan and serve. And these all get to ways that Google ultimately delivers information. Can you describe these three areas and describe what you mean by category of responsibility?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Google, as I said, is creating a tremendous amount of friction in various markets and various places around the world. And so one of the things I wanted to do was sort of break down the variety of Google services into three what I think are fairly distinct categories, and each one deserves a different level of scrutiny, a different level of regulation, because they each exhibit a different level of responsibility over the content. So starting from the idea that there's stuff out there that not everybody wants to see in all contexts, right? There's troublesome content. In some places, that's pornography. Could be infringing copyright infringements. It could be privacy violations. For all of this troublesome content, Google, of course, risks backlash and sometimes criminal prosecution, as we saw in Italy for keeping stuff available beyond the tolerance level of the particular state. So I tried to break down Google's activities into these three different areas. So the first one, you know, basically rank and link. The important thing to hear is that we're talking about search. And in Google's basic web search function, Google does not host this material directly on its servers. You know, you and I are posting things to our own servers, to our own blogs. And Google comes along and grabs the stuff and makes a copy for its own index, but that's not the important part here. The important part is that at no point did Google ask us to write anything or post anything. At no point did Google tell us we couldn't post it. At no point is Google spending any money or making any money directly off of our initial posting. What Google does, though, is perform the service of a search engine. Which means we don't want Google to have to go around saying, do I really want this in my index or is it too troublesome, right? To have that kind of burden, that editorial burden, would be too much, right? We would never really have search engines. It would be too expensive to run a search engine if we expected search engines to, edit what they scan in for their servers. I mean, sorry, for their service, not for their and really pay close attention to what other third-party servers are doing. And so, I think this process deserves the lowest level of regulatory scrutiny because it has the lowest level of responsibility. Google is frankly not very responsible and shouldn't be held responsible for the crazy things that we do with our own content on third-party servers. But then there's the next level. The next level involves hosting actual content, right? In this case, think about YouTube. Think about Blogger. Google invites us to create content and upload it to Google-owned servers. And therefore, you know, Google has a much higher level of responsibility over what exists on those servers and what goes out to the world. And then even higher than that is the capture process, right? The capture and serve functions of Google. In this case, Google is going out into the world and digitizing things that are not already digitized. Google is using Google employees and Google equipment to take pictures of streets throughout the world for Google Street View, right? Driving a car down the street and creating digital images and then loading it up to Google servers and offering it to us through Google Maps. Or the book program is another great example where Google is sending Google employees into libraries to scan all these millions of books. And Google decides which books come first and Google decides which books are extraneous and redundant. And so Google is making a series of clear editorial decisions and not only digitizing, but ultimately Googleizing this material. And so this third area, I think, demands the highest level of scrutiny and the highest level of regulation, because Google is most responsible for it. The trick is here that in all of Google's public statements about regulation, about litigation, Google wants the lowest possible standard. Google wants the same standard that I think is reasonably applied to search, applied to all their other activities. So, for instance, with Google Street View, if anyone has a complaint that, oh my gosh, you have this embarrassing picture of me, or oh my gosh, you can see inside my windows through Google Street View, Google's response every time is, well, what's the problem? You can just ask us to remove it, right? But this relies on a couple of things. First of all, you have to assume that everyone goes to Google Street View to look for themselves, and look for themselves in all situations. And you have to assume that that sort of remedy is actually adequate. I mean, in a lot of cases, embarrassing images are up on Google Street View for weeks before the party recognizes it. And by that time, you know, people have copied it and probably sent it to me as an email attachment. I get email attachments, you know, every week from people around the world saying, hey, look at this crazy thing I found on Google Street View. and you know, it's to me, that's bad faith, that Google would expect that a project as intensive and Google-controlled as Street View should have the same sort of opt-out provision as search, right? That the default is everything's in and everything's open to everybody, and only if you object can you have it removed. And you know, the same thing with the copyright question with books. You know, their answer to the copyright challenges at first was simply, what's the problem? If you don't want your book in there, just tell us, right? And this assumed that every copyright owner in the world actually paid attention to Google at that moment and was constantly watching to see whether his or her property popped up in Google Books. And, you know, that was just unrealistic. You know, as we know, as Google's been trying to identify the owners of much of this work, it's almost impossible, right? And so just this notion that the default should be always set at the lowest possible standard, I think, is folly. Now, in terms of the copyright question and Google Books, I actually don't think that Google's position on opt-out is necessarily the wrong one. I wish that the law actually allowed institutions, Google and libraries and everybody else, to use copyrighted works by default until the copyright holder says, hey, wait a minute. I don't think that's a bad standard. I just think it's improper to assume that the same standard should always apply to every kind of relationship that Google has with content and with us.
We're chatting with Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan, author of the book The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, as we record this show today on March 8th, you know, it's interesting that you raise these copyright issues, because just yesterday the Supreme Court granted certiorari in Golan v. Holder, which deals with these very issues of restoring works to the public domain, and that's an issue that I think I'll defer to for a later date in inviting you back, Shiva. But the timeliness is there as well. We have about 10 minutes left, and this is where I get to my unfair questions portion of the show. And by unfair, I mean you don't have enough time. You don't have the luxury that you've had up to now to answer the questions as thoroughly as you might like. I really want to get to two questions. Let me ask this one first. There have been proposals made by people like Frank Pasquale and others that search engines themselves should be regulated, and that search should be regulated. What's your view on whether search should be regulated? And within that question, what's your view on how much the public should know about Google's algorithm?
Yeah, this is such a thorny question. The first thing we have to recognize is that search is regulated around the world in various ways, so it's not a thoroughly deregulated activity. I mean, copyright alone is the most pervasive regulatory system we have on the internet, and it touches everything that Google does. So the real question is search properly regulated, and is it regulated in the way that serves the public the best and maintains the legitimate advantages that, you know, certain companies have earned. And so this is why it's one of the more difficult regulatory questions around. So I think there's a good argument to make that, and I've made it, that we would be better off if we didn't just have to trust a company like Google to do search in a fair way, in an uncorrupted way. Now, we know that, you know, Google does not take cash under the table to push a company higher in web search. We also know, oddly, and I have to tell you, this has been one of the most disturbing things about all the publicity I've done for this book. People actually think that Google does take cash. I've had a number of radio interviews around the country where the host will just blatantly state this, and I've had to correct him or her. And I've had a number of questions at public lectures about this question. People actually think that Google takes money to alter web search, which, you know, just baffles me. And yet, of course, they still use it, right? So, so someday, some search service might not be as ethical as Google. It might not treat us as well. And someday, Google itself might decide to do some sleazy things in terms of the placement of web search. We already know that Google is making editorial decisions about the relative value of search results. Just 2 weeks ago, we saw that Google announced it's going to favor what it calls high quality sites over low quality sites explicitly. I think it's always done this, but it's now doing it much more explicitly.
Right.
So Google's basically saying, look, we are now going to impose our values on search in ways that we have either not done before or not admitted we did before. So there are all sorts of questions about what that means, right? If we're living in a world where there are only one or two or maybe three search engines and they all start using the same principles and one or two maybe starts getting a little bit sleazy, then you know, this really important function of navigating our world becomes deeply threatened. This is why Frank Pasquale's work, I think, is so important. It really makes this issue clear. And so instead of to examine this question, we have to sort of say, okay, what kind of basic search principles do we think we would want to enforce at a national level? And that's a tough one even to imagine, because there's no such thing as neutrality. To talk about search engines being perfectly neutral is terribly naive. Search engines must make value-based decisions. To declare neutrality in search as a possibility is to accept the line that algorithms can be neutral, and they can't. They are expressions of the values baked into them by their creators. So once you recognize that, you have to say, okay, well, maybe we should demand better transparency. We should demand that companies better describe the factors that would make one item appear above another in search. And that, I think, is closer to where we want to get. But again, you don't want to get too detailed in this demand. And you want to have, and this is where I think Frank Pasquale's work is really valuable, you want to have some council of experts that can judge whether search firms are actually living up to their word. And that means being able to actually see the code and see the results and do a statistical analysis of the results. And that's going to be really hard to implement, but I think all over time we might see it really necessary. But let's also remember, we don't want to go too far in demanding that search companies expose their secret sauce, right? We don't want Google to lose the competitive advantage that it has developed over the years by hiring really smart people and putting lots of hours into its algorithms. You know, we don't want some other company, major company, to mimic Google search simply because it's managed to piece together the clues from publicly available information. You know, reverse engineering from the results back is hard enough. And one of the things to remember here, though, is as Google search results get more personalized and more localized. You know, the notion of neutrality and the notion of sort of, you know, uncorrupted search becomes harder to imagine. I mean, I'm sorry, not uncorrupted search, but unbiased search becomes harder to imagine every day. You know, your search results are not going to be my search results. So how, what standard is Google using? If it's all going to be about satisfying my previously expressed desires, then, you know, that's all we're going to get. And, we at that point, we may not even have to worry about it because we're not going to get anything truly useful when it comes to public debate or essential information to try to discover the world. But I think that's a bit too much of a nightmare scenario down the line.
Shiva, in our last few minutes, we have about four. I want to ask you about an idea that you closed the book with, which is what you call your human knowledge project. What is that, and how should researchers and individuals be involved in it?
So the Human Knowledge Project is a 50-year goal to create a global digital library. And by library, I really mean library. I mean, create a service that actual on-the-ground libraries can tap into to make sure that a child growing up in South Africa has no information disadvantage compared to a child growing up in Sweden or Canada. I would like to see us try to keep that as a goal, right? That no part of the world should be disadvantaged unless its state leaders decide that it should be disadvantaged, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we already have the technology to do this, but as I said, we lack the political will. We also lack a firm agenda of what needs to be done to make it happen. One of the things we need to do is have a global copyright reform movement that builds on the access to knowledge movement. That makes this a priority and makes the short-term interests of copyright holders less of a priority. Figure out a way for libraries to actually present this sort of information without having this veto power of copyright holders. We also have to figure out how to deal with different standards of decency and standards of censorship around the world. That's, of course, a terribly hard problem. But one worth addressing if we actually care about the problem. And we have to worry about raising the money to do it. And that is, again, a problem that requires political action and political will. And so fundamentally, this is a political book. This is a book that says we need to stop relying on the goodwill of a handful of companies to make our lives better. If we actually want our lives to be better, we need to take control of it. We need to outline our agendas. We need to campaign for it. And if we don't do this, then we actually didn't want it in the first place. So the Human Knowledge Project is about envisioning a global public library system that benefits libraries and users around the world equally. It's never going to be perfect. It's never going to be easy. But it's sort of a test of our will. If we actually think the world will be better off, then let's go ahead and do it. If we don't, if we want to argue that this or that is impossible, then let's just suspend the dream and let Google make money being Google.
Professor Shiva Vidyanathan, author of the book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Thank you for joining us on the show today. I certainly, as I mentioned, invite you back to continue this discussion. But thank you for joining us today and bringing these ideas to my listeners.
It's my pleasure.
I'm happy to mention a number of guests that will be coming up next quarter. This is the second to last show of KZSU's quarter before we take a several-week hiatus. But coming up next week is Professor John Taranian of Chapman University School of Law, author of a very entertaining book, despite what is a difficult topic, author of the book Infringement Nation. Coming up next quarter, among other guests, will be Professor Andy Hiley of Elon University School of Law, my colleague, discussing his work on online sales taxation. Professor Jennifer Jennifer Urban, the director of the Samuelson Law Technology and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley School of Law, Professor David Post of Temple University Beasley School of Law, author of the book In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace, Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School, Professor Dan Solub of George Washington University Law School, author of the forthcoming Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security, Kevin Paulson of Wired Magazine, author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 Billion Cybercrime Underground, Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants, Adam Pennenberg of New York University, author of Viral Loop from Facebook to Twitter, How Today's Smartest Businesses Grow Themselves, and Pamela Long, author of A Fascinating History of the Obelisk, and having an appropriate book co-authored called Obelisk, A History. I'm also working on bringing on other guests to come up next quarter and down the road. If you have any suggestions for people I should have on the show and any comments or feedback, you can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a number of ways you can pick up the show. You can listen live this quarter, at least Tuesdays from 11 to 12, 11 a.m. to noon on Tuesdays. Or you can get the show by podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to the iTunes search engine and finding Stanford Center for Advanced Society, or by going to Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you very much for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned for more programming on KZSU, and I will talk to you next week.